Adrian, how are you, my friend?
Doing really good, man, in Atlanta, which is great because that's where a couple of my favorite bands come from, like Allman Brothers, Black Rose.
Well, I have to say thank you so much for taking the time to do this, by the way.
My pleasure, man.
I have been a fan of yours since 1988, and so this is without a doubt like one of my bucket list interviews, so I'm super excited.
Well, I'm honored, man. Thanks very much.
Before we get started, I just want to kind of loosen up a little bit and ask you. You've been doing press, obviously, for a very, very long time.
Yes.
What is a question that you get asked so much that if you get asked it, like every time you someone asks it, like you like die inside a little bit, where you're like,
I don't think I have one, you know. It's the thing is, and that has only gotten better over time. In the 80s, of course, as we all know, especially the early 80s, a lot of the journalists or wannabe journalists were really young, and sometimes they were, let's put it diplomatically, the questions weren't always just as interesting. But overall, I've been doing interviews ever since I was about 18, you know. I always love it to talk about music. I never really look at it as an interview. It's basically you're talking with somebody else who is also into music. You're basically talking about music, and often it's about mine, of course. But still, you know, it's there's always an angle to it that makes it interesting, or it kind of stimulates my mind to take a side road that leads to something that we haven't talked about before, because it triggers something in my brain or was left of my brain. And
if you get some folks doing interviews that are kind of like myself, maybe you're not getting like the real journalist, but maybe you're getting a little more engaging questions because someone's coming at it as someone who's familiar with you and your legacy and whatnot. So have you found that to be kind of a true statement?
Yeah, that's been more and more the case. This was actually where I was getting at a little earlier. Most of the people I talk to are people who have grown with me, basically, and who have stayed in rock journalism. Because, of course, you know, it's exactly the same as musicians. A lot of them, when they're older than 25, they kind of move to family life and like a steady job and all the stuff, and their life changes, you know? So I find that these days, I've done literally the last, since the 2020 album, I've probably done about 300 interviews, and about 80% of them have been just interesting talks about music and about, you know, like sides about it that you start to think about when you're older than 25, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I'm almost 25 now, so I know where it comes from.
Me too. I mean, I just turned 19. So like, you know, yeah. Or actually, maybe I'll turn 21 tomorrow night and you can buy me a drink. But I do want to touch on something that you said something about like the science of music and like that side. It's such an interesting thing. I don't know if you've ever heard of it, but I read a book about a year ago called This Is Your Brain on Music.
Oh, I haven't heard it. No. Okay.
It's an incredible book. And what it is it was basically like a neuroscientist and, you know, psychiatrist, psychologists. And what they talk about is they talk about the science of music and how our brain interprets music. Like, what is it about certain songs that give you goosebumps or make you the hair on your arm stand up? Or like when you hear a song, like you can hear 10 songs that you know, but maybe one of those songs makes you go, oh, and like remember something good, you know? And like, so music to me is such a fascinating, a fascinating medium of that. It's not even just entertainment, but that it's communication.
Well, yeah, look, that's it. It's communication, and it's a universal language.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't speak a word Kazakhstan, for instance, but when I would play in Kazakhstan, I'm sure I would be able to move people with the stuff that I play or that I wrote or whatever, and that happens every night. I mean, talking about hair standing up on your arms, that happened to me ever since we started playing the States 2 weeks ago. Every night, without exception, and the first two or three nights were extreme. I mean, I've got some serious hair on my arms, not as much on my head, the people rose up. I mean, there's one interesting thing. This is the first tour ever where all the shows are seated. I haven't experienced that before, but so that was kind of weird. But the last couple of songs, slowly but surely, all the people stand up, and that really raised the hair on my arms. And I thought, man, that's what music does, the power of music, you know, and the connection you hopefully get with the crowd. Is almost transcendental, you know. It's like a, it's a different a parallel universe. It was the Dutch version of that word, is universum, but it's universe. You learn some Dutch here, so yeah. That's the amazing thing with music, you know. And I'm still a fan, and I will always be a fan. And like you mentioned before, I think you touched on the on that thought. Music is time machine also, you know. There are songs from the period when I was a teenager that I didn't like at all at the time, and now when I hear them on the radio, I think, oh, that's cool, you know. You have good memories and stuff, nostalgic maybe, or at the same time it can be uplifting, it can be depressing. Whenever I'm in my car for a late drive in Holland, because usually in Holland is the size of a post stamp, basically. So most of the shows I do in Holland, you drive back the same night. And I've been doing that ever since I was 16. And usually at night, when I want to give myself a kick up the butt and stay awake, I put some AC/DC on, or Van Halen, or uplifting stuff. And at the same time, you know, there's stuff that takes me to another place, which usually happens when I play one of Jeff Beck's tracks from his last decades. That takes me to a place I didn't know yet, and that's also amazing, you know. And I play a lot of classical music at home, because it has to do with the fact my sister is a classical concert pianist, and my dad played really great piano and trombone and all the stuff as a hobby in jazz bands and whatever. And so there was always classical music in the house, and that left a lot of echoes bouncing around in my mind, which is why my guitar style has a lot of connections with classical music. A lot of people think I had lessons. I never had lessons. I can't read a note, but it's somewhere in the floating around, you know. Yeah, music is an amazing thing, and I feel privileged each and every day that it has become my job. It doesn't even feel like a job, but it sometimes feels like a job when you've got an endless travel to be on a stage for an hour and a half, and you go, man, you got to be fucking nuts to be a musician, you know, a traveling musician, because it's ridiculous. A lot of people think, oh, these guys make a lot of money. Well, you don't, because in the case of what we're doing right now, it could very well be that I'm not going to make any money at all on this tour, you know. The costs are so high these days, and usually the fees the bands in my category get paid hasn't changed since 30 or 40 years ago. So and if you do make money, you know, if you relate it to the hours that you make, it's ridiculous, no? There's not that many people who are willing to work 18 hours a day for the kind of money that you usually make, you know. So it's a beautiful thing. That's how I look at it. It's a beautiful thing that I'm fortunate enough to people allow me to do this, because it's the people in the crowd and people like you who basically allow me to do this. You know, by the time nobody would show up for my shows, it could be time to scratch myself behind my ear and go, you know, maybe it's time to get my ass off stage. But I hope the time is never going to come.
I remember reading an interview with it was with Joe Perry from Aerosmith, probably about 20 years ago, 22 years ago. And in the interview, he had said something. I mean, I can't quote it right off the bat, but basically, it was someone asked him one time, "Do you ever get nervous on stage before you go on stage?" And he said, like the 10 minutes before he goes on stage, he says he feels like he wants to just throw up. And sometimes he does throw up. And the interviewer asked her, said, that must be terrible. He says, it's the greatest feeling ever because when I don't feel that way, I know it's going to be time to stop.
Yeah, that's right. He's one of the real musicians. It's a survival of the fittest kind of thing. People who go into this business for the money, in general, give up pretty quickly, even if they have made them a lot of money. But the sooner they start making less money, they kind of stop. They go, ah, I'm going to do something else, or people who made a few million and stop. For my standards, it's totally personal. They weren't in it for the music in the first place.
All right.
There's probably going to be exceptions, but Joe, he's been around. Aerosmith is one of my all-time favorite bands.
Oh,
That's the real
yeah.
deal. Those guys are the real deal. Steve Perry sings like crazy still. The guy is around 80 or something. I don't know how he sings now, but the last time I heard him sing a couple of years ago, I go, holy moly. That guy, he's like a unique personality, and he's one of those guys, whether it's singers or guitar players or whatever. I love it when you hear 2 seconds of somebody and you know exactly who it is. For guitar players, it's Brian May, it's Michael Schenker, it's Jeff Beck, it's Hendrix, it's T-Bar Yvonne, it's Leslie West. All my heroes are still my heroes, and you hear 3 notes, that's that guy. I find that more difficult these days. I think it has a lot to do with the fact that the last 2 generations start playing and having lessons on YouTube from the technically most gifted players like Steve Vai or Joe Satriani or whatever. So to me, most of them sound very similar. And they have a very similar sound also, because in the 70s and early 80s, guys like Brian May and Eddie Van Halen, and earlier guys like, of course, Hendrix, of course, and Leslie West of Mountain. Those guys came to a signature sound because they were trying to squeeze a sound out of an amp that wasn't necessarily the amp wasn't necessarily built for that. So as a guitar player, you hear the sound in your head and you want to get as close as possible. But since Eddie came up with this sound, everybody has been going after that kind of sound. And Eddie, I was fortunate enough to know him and to visit his house every once in a while. But for me, the thing with Eddie was when he came to the rehearsals of a short-lived band that I had with Rudy Sarzo, Tommy Aldridge, and Ron Young, when we were rehearsing in Palm Springs, Eddie came to one of the rehearsals because he was playing golf around there. And he picked up my treble guitar, which was like a Japanese copy of a Strat. He picked it up. It was even unamplified. There was no amplifier connected to it. He just picked it up. It was Eddie right away, The big part is in your fingers. That's it. And your tack and your timing and all the stuff, And that's what makes music so beautiful.
I grew up in the 70s, but I really came to be a music lover and a musician in the 80s, like starting around 84 or so. That was when I started to discover hard rock and metal and guitar players and everything that was exciting. And even now, when I go back and I listen to, I mean, like even, the Alibi album, or I listen to Out of the Cellar by Rat, or I listen to Breaking the Chains by Dokken. I can line all three of those guitars up and I can go, that's Vandenberg, that's Demartini, that's Lynch. But like you guys could all be playing the same chord through the same amplifier, but have a different sound. And I feel like even back then, and maybe you can correct me if I know this, is that the amount of effects that back then too was also a lot more limited than what we have now with the huge digital age and digital platforms for guitars and stuff. So it really was kind of more about like tone and attack. Am I correct with that, or?
Yeah, you're right. I had a really great time with Warren Martini when he was doing a tour with us with Whitesnake as well.
I remember, yeah.
We had a great time. He's a lovely guy, great player, great sound, and we both played the same amps. Like, we both sounded very different, and He's a different player. I'm a different player, and I always thought we complemented each other very well. And actually, the same went for, with Steve Vai. Everybody thought, "Oh man, you know this competition." Now, music can't be a competition. You know, you can't really compete with emotions. You can't say that guy is more emotional than that guy. No, everybody has got their own emotions. So,
Five 5 minutes, guys. Sorry, I
okay.
have to do this.
Want to
I'm
imagine, Ralph?
closing the
Yeah,
door.
we got sound check coming up, but. That's another beautiful thing about music, you know. People who speak their own language, whether you're a guitar player or a drummer or a vocalist, and you connect with your own language, then to me, that's when it becomes interesting.
Obviously, you're on the Jeff Tate tour, and I grew up a huge Queensryche fan, and around the same time, I was discovering Whitesnake as well. Which I discovered Vandenberg as well. So, how is the tour been going with you guys as far as that? And I have to honestly say that this is a collaboration in my mind that needs to happen, Tate and Vandenberg. I mean, I'm just gonna throw that out there.
I'll never say never. I think it's a really great combination because, as you know, because you got into both bands in the same period. We are quite different in style, very different. But there's also an overlapping part, so it's great for the fans. I think it's so much cooler a combination like this than two very similar bands. Like for instance, a lot of bands from LA in the '80s sounded very, very similar. And they all have the same influences. I'm European. I have very different influences, talking about classical music before and jazz and all kinds of stuff, you know. But what makes this tour so interesting that we're both Tate's band and my band are very different. We play a lot of Whitesnake material this tour, about 70% of the set, much to request from both the fans and our touring agent, because he had lots of people, lots of local promoters asking him, "Can you ask Adrian to play a lot of Whitesnake stuff?" Because, as we know, you know, Whitesnake is not touring anymore, and I happily passed the torch because I was a part of Whitesnake for 12 years, and I've been involved with all those songs, you know. So
Good luck, and I'm gonna see you tomorrow night.
yes, I got to catch you with my tour manager, Ralph. And he will
Okay.
make sure we get to shake hands.
Adrian, have a great show tonight. We'll talk again soon.
Yeah, great man. Great talking to you. See you tomorrow. Bye.
Well, as you can tell, I really enjoyed talking to Adrian. He was such a great guy, so personable and so engaging, and just really loves talking about music. After our interview was over, he expressed to me how much he enjoyed it, which, of course, to me was a huge honor and compliment. I ended up catching up with Adrian after their set in Myrtle Beach, which was fantastic, and we kind of picked up right where we left off. It was like talking to an old buddy. He was such a cool guy. And after we got done talking for about 20 minutes or so, he said, "Hey, we should do this again, do a part two or something." So I actually did manage to get a hold of him right before sound check at the Cannes Ballroom show that he did with Jeff Tate. And this is the next part of that interview. So, wasn't expecting a part two, but here's the continuation of my interview with the legendary Adrian Vandenberg. Thank you for doing this again. I really appreciate it because I had such a good time talking to you. I felt like it ended too quickly.
Yeah, we had a great talk. You know, as I told you, it's always great to talk about people who are passionate about music. And it rarely feels like an interview, you know. It's usually a conversation which you have with another music lover. That's basically what it is.
Well, it was great to talk to you in Myrtle Beach when you were here, man. I really enjoyed our chat.
Yeah, me too. And the weird thing is about touring, you know, the guys and I regularly talk about it. We've been on the road now for about 5 weeks, but even Myrtle Beach feels like it's been 2 months ago or something, because you're in a different city every day, of course, pretty much every day. So you experience you get a lot of input from all kinds of directions. Like for instance, today is an amazing venue. It's a it used to be a ballroom in 1924. And a whole bunch of my heroes have played there, from Leslie West, Freddie King, Buddy Guy, even Robert Plant, Kings of Leon, Jerry Lee Lewis. Oh man, there's a list of posters ever since the 30s, basically.
You're at Kane's Ballroom tonight, right?
Yes.
Oh, yes. I thought that's where you were talking about. That is an gorgeous
It's amazing.
venue.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's I'm really impressed, you know, and you feel humbled whenever I run into one of those venues, realizing who has played there over the last decades. You know, we're talking about 50, 60, 70 decades, and I think, man, who the fuck am I to be allowed to play in places like this? You know, it's still a passion that went way out of hand.
I saw you in 1988 in New Orleans with Whitesnake. You probably saw me. I was like way in the back, you know.
Yeah.
I'd made a Whitesnake banner at school. I printed it out on a dot matrix printer, and I brought it. And I was like, I don't think they're gonna see this.
Oh, cool.
The last time you had really toured the States was in '90, I guess, right? With Whitesnake.
Yeah.
There, you were going to all these big venues, arenas, everything, right? And now you're back for the first time in all these 36, 30 something years, and you're getting to play these like smaller, intimate venues. Do you feel like you're getting more of a feel for the American music culture by playing the smaller places as opposed to an arena every night?
Oh yeah, big time, you know. I absolutely love it. As a matter of fact, in the in my 12 years at Whitesnake, I regularly try to convince David every once in a while, especially on his third tour, to when it was possible to see if we could play like a somewhat smaller theater once in a while. Production-wise, it was quite difficult, but a couple of times we did that. As everybody knows, in the United States, most of the arenas and stadiums are very similar when you're backstage. You know, the backstage areas are always very similar, and so are the actual venues. I always get up early in the morning, and whenever I'm in whatever city it is, I like to walk around and get a taste of the city and the region and talk to the people and have a cup of coffee here and there. So I tried to get as much of America over the years with every tour that I could possibly get. But playing these venues is a huge kick. I really, really love it. And especially considering what I mentioned before, that all those legendaries and legendary artists and some of them huge influences on me. You know, Leslie West played in this ballroom tonight, and Freddie King. Those are two very big influences my playing. Bob Dylan, who played there, was an indirect influence because I started appreciating him more when Hendrix covered All Along the Watchtower and stuff. I thought, who's that song? And I was aware of Bob Dylan, but I couldn't really deal with his style of singing easily because I was spoiled with guys like Paul Rodgers. And when Hendrix said in one of his interviews that he was always shy about singing because he didn't like his own singing until he discovered Bob Dylan and found a way to like half read half or like half read a poem and half sing, kind of, which became his style. I started appreciating it way more, and I've always been like a big Tom Petty fan, and he has got a similar way of doing his vocals. And yeah, it took a while because, like I said, you know, I mean, if I grew up with guys like Paul Rodgers and Otis Redding. That's another one. I was in Memphis the other day, and I went to Otis Redding Museum, invited his grandson, who was running the museum. It was such a blast, you know. Otis Redding, big influence, and I played his records to death. I was in those days, you know, when I was 15 and 16, you were not supposed to like blues and hard rock at the same time with soul in my school. You know, they said you were either this or you're that, you know. Everything is blues and soul influenced has been my influences, you know. Like I know that Otis Redding was a big influence on Paul Rodgers, and you're going to hear it. And all the soul guys, you know, Sam and Dave, and you name them, Eddie Floyd, Knock on Wood, you know, great stuff. And I still play it in my car, you know, when I want to hear real R&B or soul, because what is called soul these days or R&B is for me, I'm old school, you know. It's like somebody shouting a lyric over a computer-generated beat, you know, to me. And that's definitely not what I consider soul or rhythm and blues or whatever, you know. I like handmade music, so yeah, I'm old school and I'm proud of it.
I don't know that I would be exposed to like even half of the music that I hear now. And one of the things that gets me so excited and so pumped is when I hear young bands coming out that have that old soul like us, you know? Because somewhere, because what it kind of hit me that some of these bands, like their parents are my age already, you know? And I'm like, wait, I'm not old enough to be. I'm like, oh wait, I am old enough to be your dad, I guess. So when I think the music that I listen to, if those kids were getting tired of the commercial music that they're hearing and they go discover their dad's albums, like even in my albums, like you're gonna find AC/DC, Led Zeppelin, but you'll find Whitesnake, you'll find Kingdom Come, you'll find The Band, the Grateful Dead, you know, so you'll find like an entire spectrum of music. So, like when you hear younger bands that are kind of coming out with that old soul feel, like that, like that old, you know, that old heart, like, are you seeing that much on your own or?
I mean, especially lately, it seems to be coming from the States mostly. As far as younger soul singers, there's a few in England. I really love James Morrison. He had one or two hits, and that was it. He seemed to have disappeared a bit. But I went to see a show. He's like a skinny, tiny, little white boy, and he sings like an old soul, like a 75-year-old colored vocalist, you know, really, really great. It's worth checking out for people who are li listening to this, you know, this episode, this broadcast. A guy called James Morrison, you know, just beautiful stuff. And that's kind of stuff I can picture like a more a rock guitar behind it, and then suddenly it becomes something like Free or Bad Company or Cream or whatever, you know. It's all entwined for me.
It's really neat for me to hear a lot of bands speak, and maybe this might have happened with you, which I'm sure it did, being a musician of your caliber. But at least for me, is I feel like the older I've gotten, the more attuned I am to wanting to hear things in bands that, like, or maybe like pay attention to things that didn't really mean much to me younger. So like, you know, if whereas like something was like great, I was like, this kicks ass. Whereas like now, it's like I want to study like the kind of layers, you know, like okay, so I hear the blues in there, I hear some jazz guitar. Oh wait, here comes a little bit of, groove or whatever, and then it starts to build this particular sound. And so like I always thought like a guitar player like you, when I listen to that, I hear the blues, I hear classical, I hear jazz, I hear all that, but at what point does it, because I mean, even though I'm a guitar player, I pretty much play like one style of music, and that's like folk music, right? But like you have such a broad palette, whereas like a lot of guitar players do. So at what point did you decide, like, okay, all this is just going to mesh together for me instead of going just one route?
Well, for me, it comes naturally. First of all, what made a big impact is my sister is a classical piano player, and my dad also plays classical piano, but also jazz and Dixieland and all that kind of stuff. So when I was you know, on my little Marshall, well, my big Marshall amp actually, in my little bedroom upstairs, as soon as I stopped playing, I heard downstairs, I heard the piano. I heard Mozart, Bach, Beethoven, Chopin, all those guys, and I've been, ever since I can remember, interested in all kinds of music as long as there's heart and soul in it. It could be Portuguese fado, it could be Greek music, you know, Greek folk music, South American music, like for instance Cuban traditional folk music. So I seem to absorb it all, and it comes out of my playing. I don't really think about it; it just kind of pops in, you know, and it shows its head around the corner, and I go, "Oh, that's wow!" That's because I just fiddle around on the guitar. I can't really read notes, not at all, actually. So when I kind of play, I don't really see it as practicing because I kind of start playing and things happen. I think, "Oh, that's a nice combination of notes," and then I try to figure out what I was doing and repeat it a couple of times, and then it kind of seems to be another ingredient in the musical apple pie that I'm trying to put together. So yeah, at the time I did not like classical music that much because I heard it all the time from my sister and my dad, and I was heavily into Hendrix and Cream and the Free, Bad Company, Mountain with Leslie West, of course, and stuff like Vanilla Fudge, Stevie Winwood. It was all blues based stuff, but then really heavy, you know. When I started out, guys like Freddie King, especially Albert King, BB King also, but Freddie, Buddy Guy, had more power to it. So that was probably the start of, I suppose, kind of blues rock guitar, because Jeff Beck with the Jeff Beck Group in the early 70s, or Stewart on vocals, was amazing. It was basically the blueprint for Led Zeppelin, which Jimmy Page, apparently, to the chagrin of Jeff Beck, never really gave Jeff credit for. But if you listen to that bootleg, the Jeff Beck Group live in Miami, those guys were like 20, 20, 21, 22 or something. It's just an amazing bootleg, and you hear basically absolutely clearly the roots of Led Zeppelin. So it's interesting, you know, all those influences that you trace back, and that's actually how I would discover a lot of bands through reading interviews with my heroes. I go, okay, this guy grew up on, like, for instance, tonight, there's a couple of country and skiffle heroes who played here in the 20s and the 30s who influenced the Beatles.
Oh, yes.
You know, like Hank Williams and those kind of guys. And you go, wow, that's interesting. And I remember reading that because I'm a huge Beatles fan. Well, who isn't, but I am. So the Stones and the Beatles, they got influenced by the American blues and soul, of course, and they made their own little pie out of it.
And that was such a thing, you know, again, like that I didn't really get until I got older and started, you know, really reading a lot of biographies and autobiographies about bands and artists, is that especially the, you know, European artists of the 50s and 60s found a way to take American music and, you know, that might not have actually been very easily accessible because, you know, as you know, I mean, let's admit it, like old school Delta blues is not the easiest kind of music on your ears.
No, it's but it was exciting, and this was probably the element that those guys missed in the really nice and polite pop music of the time. And if you listen to the first Beatle lyric, "I want to hold your hand," it's all very adolescent, of course, because they were. But you know, when they heard people like Little Richard and those kind of guys, they got, and Chuck Berry, they go, "Oh man," you know, because suddenly there was a sexual element in it that was really exciting for the teenagers back then, that they didn't hear from their parents, you know, let alone guys like Elvis. I mean, how great does it have? How great must it have been for Paul McCartney to hear Elvis Presley cover a song like "Yesterday" that he wrote when he was 21, 22 or something? And of course, the same goes for Paul Rodgers and Andy Fraser. "Fire and Water" was covered by, I think it was Otis Redding, I think it was, or Wilson Pickett, one of those guys. When you're a little spotty white British kid, 22 years old, and one of your heroes covers one of your songs, you go, "Whoa, man, that's gonna be amazing."
Are you familiar with Tony Joe White? Do you know Tony Joe White?
Oh yeah, oh, big time, big time. I love the guy.
I had the pleasure of seeing Tony Joe White live 3 times, and I got to meet him the last time I saw him, and he was the nicest guy. And I remember, and he played this little tiny blues club in Charlotte, and there was like maybe 50 people there. And after the show, me and my buddy went over to meet him. And he's like, y'all talk like this, very deep, you
Yeah,
know? And I
yeah,
remember I
yeah.
asked him, I said, Tony, I have to ask you a question. He was like, yeah, go ahead. And I was like, how did you feel like when Elvis, you know, decided he wanted to cover Poke Salad Annie? And
Yeah.
he says, buddy, the first thing I thought was, I'm never gonna have to work a day in my life.
Yeah, and he kept going. That's a good thing, you know. It's yeah, that guy was amazing. I remember seeing him on a television show in Holland about 7, 8 years ago or something. Oh, a German television show, I think.
But see, he'd go to Germany, he'd go to Holland, and he'd go to all these countries, and he'd play these big, like blues and arts festivals and stuff, where he'd be playing to a few thousand people, and then he'd come over to the U.S. And I remember asking him also. I said, does it ever bum you out that you're only playing to, like that you play to these small crowds? And he said, no, he goes, because I'd rather play to 50 people that know every one of my songs and appreciate it than to play to 1,000 people where only 50 people know my songs and appreciate them.
That's how it is because you for the music, you know?
Thanks again for doing this, man. It's been amazing to talk
My
to
pleasure,
you.
man. My pleasure.
And what's going on after this tour is over? Are we going to see you come back to the States again, maybe for a headline swing or something?
We got a another Dutch tour coming up, 10 shows, and then we do a bunch of European festivals. And then our agency, Reliant Agency, is working on another United States tour the end of the year. So that will be around November or something. So I'm really looking forward to come back, you know, because it's such a kick after all those years. It's been really weird after having played here so much, such a so many shows, not just with Whitesnake, but also with early Vandenberg in 1983 with Ozzy Osbourne, 1984 with Kiss, a lot of big arena shows, and now, you know, now finally I'm playing all those legendary clubs that I read about when I was a teenager. Like for instance, when we were in Macon, Georgia, a couple of days ago, that's where the Allman Brothers are from, and that's where Otis Redding was from, predominantly, and Little Richard. But Allman Brothers were a huge influence on me. I wore out that Allman Brothers live at the Fillmore.
That's still one of my top favorite records right now, of all time.
It's an amazing record. And considering Greg Allman was like 21 or something, he had a voice of a black guy in the 70s, you know, really amazing. The scorching Hammond organ, the amazing slide player from Duane, and Dickie Betts, you know, I mean, those guys were amazing. And so I went to the Capricorn Museum in Macon, where all that was recorded, or a lot of the stuff. And I actually touched the piano where Otis Redding wrote a lot of his stuff on. So, man, I would almost think after this tour my life is complete, but it's not because I'm just getting started. So that's the way it is.
Well, Adrian, it's like you're having a rebirth, man. And I can't tell you how excited and happy I am that you're doing it and that I got to see you. And it has been like a real honor and a privilege to talk to you. And you're an amazing dude to talk to. I really appreciate you.
Pleasure, man. Take care, man. Bye-bye.